billion people no doubt will agree, this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on the shores.
Good morning, and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for Friday, the 13th of September, 2019. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Last month was the one-year anniversary of the IPCC report. That's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Titled Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees C. And that explained how the planet has about 12 years to resolve the problem of climate change before tipping into some uncontrollably worldwide climate chaos. Well, so we're 1 year into that 12-year time frame. That's about 8% of the way along, with 11 years left to solve this global problem. Yet, as many listeners know, the problem has only gotten worse over the last year. And that leads us into today's topic. We'll be discussing today a novel idea published recently called Cap and Adapt, a Fail-Safe Approach to the Climate Emergency. That's the title of an essay published a few weeks ago at resilience.org. And our guest today is one of the two co-authors of the piece, Stan Cox. Stan is the research coordinator at the Land Institute, based in Salina, Kansas. That's a nonprofit science-based research organization established in 1976 that is creating a sustainable agricultural alternative to current destructive agricultural practices based on perennial grain crops and polyculture farming solutions that has the ecological stability of the prairie and a grain yield comparable to that from annual crops. He previously worked for the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, developing new disease-resistant wheat germplasm using hybrids between wheat and its wild ancestral species. He is on the editorial board of Green Social Thought and written on environmental issues for newspapers worldwide, including the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, as well as some online media like Counterpunch, Alternet, and other online publications. He's the author of three books, Any Way You Slice It, The Past, Present, and Future of Rationing, and Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World, both published by New Press, and a book called Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine. And then more recently, he's co-authored with his son, Paul Cox, the book How the World Breaks, Life and Catastrophe's Path from the Caribbean to Siberia. And then his next book, scheduled for release next year, will be called The Green New Deal and Beyond. So let's have a look at Cap and Adapt, a Fail-Safe Approach to the Climate Emergency. Stan Cox, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Very good to be with you, Steve and Annie.
Yeah, thanks so much. We appreciate it, especially now. This is sort of the month of September. There's a lot of focus right now on the climate crisis, like there should be all the time. So we're really happy to have you here. You have this new book coming up that Steve mentioned, and one just out, I guess, a year ago or so. And that one, How the World Breaks, the subtitle is Life and Catastrophe's Path from the Caribbean to the Siberia, which kind of gives us a glimpse at how broad the problem is. It's not just Miami Beach or the Bahamas. Do you want to talk a little bit about the scope of our crisis?
Well, we're seeing increases in catastrophic in catastrophes all over the world, and there the variety of them from these much more powerful hurricanes, tropical cyclones, which and that was predicted by the modelers years ago, that we wouldn't necessarily have more hurricanes, but that they would become more powerful and destructive, and we're certainly seeing that. And then wildfires, as I don't have to tell y'all, that is the rate of increase in number and intensity of wildfires, not only in California, but in Australia and Siberia, and right now in Alaska, of all places, is another indication that we've pushed things too far in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I like the comparison you make to an athlete, and he can, you know, he still make the same number of home runs, but on steroids. Oh, they're out of the park.
Right.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the, well, we did mention a minute ago, Miami Beach. That's kind of what would you call it, a poster child for climate craziness? Do you want to talk about that particular place where it's kind of flooding all the time and people don't seem to think it's a problem?
Right. Paul and I had a chapter on Miami Beach as our went. All the other chapters were on the aftermath of recent disasters, but Miami was our future disaster because it is an inevitability there, because the sea level has risen enough already that Miami Beach and parts of mainland Miami Beach is a barrier island, and then it and parts of the coastal Miami are having what they call sunny day flooding. That when there is a high tide, the sea level has risen far high enough now that the high tide on top of that is pushing water up through the limestone foundation of Miami Beach, and it's a very porous rock, and the water comes on up through the storm drains and so forth, and fills quite a few of the streets there, and threatens the luxury condo complexes and so forth. And they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars dealing with what's essentially a climate change. Feet. So I was asking them that because I was asking the city engineer. We were going along by these storefronts, and I said, "Well, if the street's 2 feet higher, and you have that flooding, it's all going to just be running into the doors of these shops, which are still at the old level." And he said, "Well, yeah, then we'll have to build a little seawall to protect the sidewalk and so forth." So they're just putting a Band-Aid over the problem rather than dealing with the problem. And they just once again just dodged a bullet with Hurricane Dorian, which would have been really catastrophic, caused tremendous flooding throughout Miami-Dade County if it had continued moving west. The great Miami hurricane of 1926 did make a direct hit on Miami, and the entire island of Miami Beach was underwater from that. And back then, only 75,000 people lived in Miami, so it wasn't the kind of catastrophe that it would today. It would be the most expensive storm ever when if it does hit.
What? Had a question of mine a moment ago and then just slipped away. The hundreds of millions. So where are they getting it?
Well, it's the I guess out of their tax revenues. I don't know if they've raised taxes or if they're getting some. Maybe some emergency aid from the state.
Okay, I can't help but be curious. And what's the limit? Yeah. When do they say that
right.
We're out, can't do anymore?
Yeah, right. The mayor of South Miami, which is a very small community, right on the edge of the bigger city of Miami, is very active in climate advocacy and so forth. And he says that what Miami Beach is doing, he calls it the bathtub strategy, because they're just making it into a big bathtub and hoping they can just keep draining water out of it.
Okay.
They've spent, I think, or they're spending something like $400 million right now. And you're right, once that's spent, and the sea level's still coming up or hurricanes hit, it's not going to be enough.
Incredible. And I assume that people are still purchasing condos there in that part of the city?
Yeah, the real estate boom there has not let up at all. It's been going strong for years. And apparently the idea, you know, that these developers, everybody, according to this, Phil Stoddard, the mayor of South Miami, he says, people will always tell you, I think we've got about another 10 years. And it's always 10 years, even year after year. It's always 10 years on the horizon. And a developer says, okay, I can get this thing built, sell all the units, and get it turned around, get my money. And then we'll see. I'll probably will have time to do it one more time. And everybody's thinking they can do one more deal, and people are buying them.
Incredible.
Yeah, just incredible. Hard to believe.
You know, you said something, and this sort of describes something you said, that these disasters are not accidents, that they're associated with preventable events, and I guess maybe that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, this is an excellent example of that.
There was a wild thing that came out in the New Yorker this week by Jonathan Franzen, and it's only wild because a lot of people are talking about it. It's not wild in the reality of our situation right now, but I thought I'd read it and get your comments because a lot of my friends are talking about it. So this is what Franzen wrote recently in the New Yorker. Overwhelming numbers of human beings, including millions of government-hating Americans, need to accept high taxes and severe curtailments of their familiar lifestyles without revolting. They must accept the reality of climate change and have faith in the extreme measures taken to combat it. They can't dismiss news they dislike as fake. They have to set aside nationalism and class and racial resentments. They have to make sacrifices for distant threatened nations and distant future generations. They have to be permanently terrified by hotter summers and more frequent natural disasters rather than just getting used to them. What do you think?
What he was doing with that passage, it was part of a longer passage in which he was saying this is the climate activists, this is the world they're envisioning for you. And it was kind of a caricature of what life's going to have to be like if we take climate seriously and do something. And so then he goes on to say that he's like the climate modelers, but he runs his model just in his own brain, and his model tells him that because of what he calls human nature, we're never going to accept the kind of limits that we have to accept if we're going to deal with climate. And so he's basically, it's kind of a case of grim resignation for him. But he and David Wallace Wells, who wrote the book The Uninhabitable Earth, and these guys are they're in a position where they can protect themselves probably and their families against the worst that might come with climate change. But their message is, we've all just got to get used to it, because there's nothing we can do about it at this point. because the it doesn't doing something about it would not be acceptable to people or to capitalism, especially in general. So we've just got to live with it.
And there seems to be. Oh, go ahead.
Well, and so what Larry and I were trying to do with the Cap and Adapt article and what I'll be doing in this book, The Green New Deal and Beyond, is to try to navigate between the what we see as the, or I see as the extremes. There's the sunny forecast of the people in, that are kind of dominant in the climate movement that everything's going to be fine. We're going to build enough solar and wind farms very quickly, and then we'll be able to carry on with life as usual. And then at the other extreme is the Frampton type of surrender and say it's all going to be a big mess and we there's nothing we can do about it. So I'm saying that if we did do what's necessary, these are the steps that we would have to take, and it's not going to be easy, but it also is not physically impossible, but it is going to require some big changes in the system, especially the economic system, if we are going to deal adequately with it.
So if I want to fly to Europe and back, it's okay if I plant a tree or a couple of trees, and then that will make up for it?
Well, yeah, that's one of the worst ideas ever are these, what you're talking about, offsets where you can, any person or entity can supposedly cancel out the emissions they're causing by paying a group in Indonesia to plant trees or protect forest in the Amazon, or in the case of, as I understand, in California's cap and trade system, they were actually, you were able to buy offsets by paying coal mining companies to reduce the methane emissions they're generating while mining coal out of the ground, so, which is going to keep the coal industry afloat longer than it would have otherwise. So these offsets have been shown to have almost never achieve any carbon benefits, and generally lead to exploitation and destruction of livelihoods and so forth.
So I had a couple questions about cap and trade and carbon-free and dividend and carbon pricing, but why don't we get right into your cap and adapt thing to make sure we get it covered, that we have time. You have an article just out. People can find it online. Cap and Adapt, a Fail-Safe Approach to the Climate Emergency. At first, I should ask you about fail-safe, because some of us, when we hear fail-safe, it's become kind of a joke that, well, it's not really fail-safe. What does your title mean?
Well, and that was the idea of Larry Edwards, who is the lead author on our article. Meaning that the other mechanisms you mentioned for trying to drive drive emissions down are indirect, and we can't predict the result, and they're kind of wishful thinking. But what's needed is a guarantee, a method that will guarantee to drive emissions down and therefore be fail-safe. Fail-safe was originally in the nuclear war theory, so it sometimes conjures up wrong images. But but you can call it foolproof or airtight or what. But what it means is that we would, by law, have a cap on the quantities of coal, oil, and gas that we extract from the ground and sell into the economy, and that lid, which would not be in dollars or carbon units or anything, it would be in barrels, cubic feet, tons of coal, that cap would be reduced year by year. So if we're going to meet the IPCC's goal and get rid of emissions in now it'll be 10 years, then all of those fuels have to be reduced 10% of the original amount every year. If we're going to do it in 20 years, then it'll have to be 5% every year. So it would be not a cap in trade, but it would be a cap and permit. And the permits would not be sold. They would just be assigned to the companies that are bringing fossil fuels into the economy. And say, you know, for every unit you sell, you have to turn over this many permits. And then that will directly reduce the emissions, at least from fossil fuels. And that similar things could be done in other parts of the economy for refrigerants or methane and other things. But what that will mean, and this is the central point, I think, is that rapid reduction in the amount of energy, fossil energy that we have available, will have to happen faster than our capacity to build renewable energy infrastructure. So there's going to be a gap, and we're going to have to live on less energy through that transition until renewable energy can be built up to fill the gap. And I believe that renewable energy is never going to be able to provide the same kind of energy consumption that we have today, and that we're in fact going to be going into a period of energy shortage if we deal sensibly with climate. That will be it will kind of echo the 1970s energy crisis, but if it's done in a more well-planned way, we can avoid the chaos and strife and stress that the country went through back then. We can do it in a way that ensures that everybody has sufficient access, not only to energy, but to goods that energy is required to produce. For example, of this dwindling quantity of fossil fuels, we'll have to guarantee that a certain amount is enough allocated to, say, agriculture to produce enough food, or that there's enough gas, natural gas, to for home heating in northern states in the winter until heating can be converted to electricity. There's going to be a gap there where we've got to use a certain part of the natural gas supply to guarantee it so that people will have enough to get through the winter. So there'll have to be quite a bit more planning of allocating resources.
Right. We're going to take a call now. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, going to run away from the radio. So, so what that brings up to me is, in terms of fuel for agriculture, is that actually agriculture can be part of the solution. And I'm just wondering, like, to hear the guests talk about what he's found out in that area, and that if we can increase organic matter in the soil, maybe that can help us through that transition period. We don't need as much energy for agriculture if we're not plowing and tilling all the time, which has been part of the problem. And so just wanted to hear the hear his thoughts on that issue.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, so you're gonna, what you're doing here is your cap and adapt is different, because not only you're capping, you are driving the emissions back. There aren't going to be as many, and you're going to keep decreasing them. And your adapt is not just adapting to this more emissions catastrophe, but adapting to doing with less. So just to sort of summarize what you said. Now, what about what our caller just said, that there's ways that agriculture could help with this?
Yes, that's an excellent point. And the last month or the month before, IPCC came out with another big report called Climate Change in Land, and they were making this point, how land use needs to change for agriculture and for other activities, needs to change in order to do two things, to stop the emissions that are being produced by the way we use land now, and then also, in it's to some extent, we can capture. That's what green plants do. They capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it as plant tissue, and put their roots down into the ground and pump carbon into the ground. So the problem is that the way we do agriculture is a net emitter of carbon dioxide, partly because we use a lot of fossil fuel to do it, and also because in going from natural landscapes to cultivation of annual crops, all the food and feed crops that we grow, 350 million acres in this country, that we're carbon is being every time we till, as the caller said, every time we cultivate the soil, it kills off the plant roots and the ecosystem that thrives in a natural ecosystem, which always has living roots in it, which fosters all kinds of microorganisms, insects, worms, all of that, who help keep organic matter in the soil. That's all gone once a year when you plow it up, and kind of metabolized by microorganisms, and the CO2 goes back into the air. So the first thing to do is to stop the bleeding of the ground, and there are a number of things that need to be done. We need to get rid of the feeding grain to cattle, get rid of all the feedlot and animal confinement systems, which depend on the entire upper Midwest being planted to corn and soybeans. That land could be converted to pasture or other perennial cover, and including what we're working on here at the Land Institute is developing perennial grain crops, which would produce harvest of grain but not have to be planted every year, and would have continuous living roots in the soil. So behave more like the native prairie that used to cover this part of the country. So that would recapture some of the CO2 that was emitted when we tore the prairie out, but it can only hold so much. So there is a limit to how much you can keep capturing, whether it's forest or native grasses, whatever kind of ecosystems there are. They can recapture CO2 that was emitted through our destructive land use, but only that much. They can't just keep storing it forever. They can't turn the layers of the deep layers of soil into one big pool of carbon.
Okay, we have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to add, this is a very interesting discussion. There's another angle, or maybe a couple more angles, besides just carbon emissions. And one of them is the topsoil crisis. And luckily, agricultural experts have been warning about this for years, that the topsoil that we depend on to grow our food crops is being steadily depleted, and the amount left is only going to last a few more decades at best. But luckily, some of the mitigation, the answer to that is somewhere along the lines of reduced tillage and sequestering carbon into the soil. So that's partially the same answer, but it's a different thing to keep in mind, and another threat that we have to keep in mind. Even some of the well-off people who are going to be able to dodge some of the worst aspects of climate change might find their food supply restricted by that problem. And the other thing is, I noticed when Greta Thunberg was talking about her work, she always talks about the climate crisis and the ecological crisis, because people are doing other things besides warming the planet that is destroying our environment. Deforestation comes to mind, overfishing, you name it. And I think we need to look at an integrated, I don't know if anybody's actually got a term for this, but it seems to me like we've got a polyvalent crisis, and we need to keep track of all the aspects of it at once. We have to deal with all of them, or we're going to be in big trouble. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Yeah, it's a polyvalent crisis. What do you think, Stan?
Right. I'm so glad our caller brought this up, because we could miraculously fix the greenhouse gas problem and still be in for a big ecological crash. There's this concept of planetary boundaries that the international group led by folks in Sweden have been talking about, and it has kind of a polyvalent diagram showing that not only for greenhouse gases, but for nitrogen and phosphorus, and for soil loss, biodiversity loss, there's several dimensions in which we are already over the limit of what can be sustained by the Earth, and we've got to resolve all of those. And the caller is right. Fortunately, dealing with the remedies with regard to land use for climate are pretty much the same remedies that we need for biodiversity loss and the nitrogen cycle and soil loss. So that's stuff that we ought to be doing even if there were not a climate crisis. So it's not easy, but that's the most straightforward part that nobody should oppose. And the tougher part is the luxuriant use of energy, electricity, and liquid fuels that people are not going to be so eager to address.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners that this is Corporations and Democracy, and we're discussing today the content of a recent article called Camp and Adapt, a Fail-Safe Approach to the Climate Emergency, and we're talking with one of its co-authors, Stan Cox, who is the research coordinator at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. The callers that called in know the number, but for those of you that do not and would like to get in on the conversation, the number here is 895-2448. Again, 895-2448 here in area code 707.
And let me just take this moment to announce a few things, like Greta Thunberg, who is referred to a couple times during this show, rightfully so. She is at the White House today striking, today, Friday the 13th. I think she does her student strike for the climate every
Friday. She's outside the White House.
Thank you for that clarification. Important point. She is outside the White House striking for the climate, as she does every Friday, and this time it is right here at the door of deniers. There is a local response. That's going to be September 20th. There's a national climate strike day, and the local response on the September 20th at the Ukiah Courthouse at noon. And then Ukiah students also on 9/20 are going to be having a rally at 3 p.m. in the Alex Thomas Plaza. And on the coast, same day, the 20th, 1 to 2 p.m., the Fort Bragg Town Hall, and in the town of Mendocino, 1 to 2 on Main Street, right across from Out of This World. So those are local responses to the national September 20th climate commotion. So to get back to, I have a question for you. I just noticed that Jeremy Rifkin has come out with this idea that fossil fuels are going to be dropped in favor of the cheaper solar and wind energy, and that trillions of dollars in fossil fuel assets are going to be stranded and cause a carbon bubble, which will burst in 2028. I just read that this morning. Do you see that? You're talking about, you know, polyvalent. Do you see that as part of our current crisis?
Well, I haven't read his book yet, but I have in my book. I'm arguing that the idea that that renewable energy sources will kind of automatically kick fossil fuels out of the market and replace them just through market forces is unsupported by any evidence at all. And when you look at the history of new energy sources, they have always come on top of what was already there. So when oil first became widely available, it didn't drive coal out of industry. We kept burning, in fact, continued to increase coal use while oil use was increasing. Then when natural gas came along, it was added on top of oil and coal. And now the new renewable energy capacity we're have been producing over the past 10 years is mostly adding to the supply of energy. It's not displacing fossil fuels. So we need a direct way to get fossil fuels out by law and on schedule, and not wait around for the market to favor renewable energy over the others. What the market favors is using all the energy that we can and always increasing the use of energy, because there's a very tight relationship between GDP and energy use.
Okay, thank you. One of the things about that you point out about the adapt part of cap and adapt, and it's a really crucial point, is that there'll be rationing and that it has to be fair. How are you going to make it fair when we have so many people in power that are even cynical, I think? They can encourage the deniers because they think they can buy their way out of it. You referred a little bit to that earlier. How do you make the adapt part just?
Well, the most detailed plan for that has been one that's been discussed pretty widely in the United Kingdom, in Britain, for a couple of decades now, in which would, first of all, what we would have to do is make sure that industries producing essential goods that get preference, and that energy resources are directed first to them and away from production of yachts or what luxury goods. But then each household, and possibly on per capita basis, would have a carbon account. And or in what we proposed would have ration credits, ration cube, electronic version of the ration coupons we had during World War II, for liquid fuel, for mostly gas and diesel for vehicles, and for electricity and in electricity, gas, and water coming into the house. So those credits would have to be surrendered then whenever you pay your utility bill or fill up your vehicle. And there would not be, in our system anyway, a way for rich people to buy their way out of it. It would, as in World War II, there was a very widespread feeling of we're all in this together, and those fat cats are not getting any more cheese than the rest of us. So we need a system like that to first of all make sure there's production of what needs to be produced, and then to have this rationing of energy, of fossil fuel energy. And there would need to be price controls also, because if energy is short and the market is determining the price of gas or electricity, it's going to go through the roof unless we have price controls. And then if you have price controls, you have to have a fair share's way of making sure everybody get some, and there's no hoarding none of the 1970s style mile long gas lines.
Yeah, you refer to World War II a couple times in describing, you know, the system that we'll have to have in place to make rationing just. But there's probably some other comparisons that can be made to World War II, because for one thing, you say that in order to have this work, the program has to be aggressive, and we always think of how people rallied all their resources during World War II. What other comparisons do we have to World War II here to actually bring this about, this saving us from more climate crisis than we already have?
But the mainstream climate movement, they've talked about World War II a lot, and mainly the analogy of the buildup of green infrastructure today being analogous to the big industrial buildup of the armaments and military industries in World War II. but they almost never talk about what that meant for the economy, which, because walling off of all of those resources, fuel, materials, metals, et cetera, for the war effort pulled them out of the civilian economy. And so it triggered shortages there. And the first things that were rationed were rubber and gasoline, and then it ramified from there. And so they had to have, in the civilian side of the economy, price controls and rationing of essential goods for the very reason that for the reason of having walled off a large part of the economy and resources for the war effort. So that's the same thing we would see today. Now, it would not be as large a part of the economy being walled off to generate the electricity or to generate the capacity for renewable electricity, but we will, the difference from World War II will be that we're going to be, if the world I'm talking about comes to be, that we will be voluntarily leaving resources in the ground, and so we will, that will put even more pressure on the energy resources that we do have, and so renewable energy will be expensive also unless we have price controls.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to run a scenario by you that goes back to the topics in your book about how the world breaks. And could you comment on this one thought that one of the shocks of the system or surprises that will get the attention of the public is it would be the scenario when one of the inevitable hurricanes in the Gulf Coast area takes out a refinery and the decision is made not to rebuild and repair it because the expenses just won't be worth it at some point. What is your thought of that scenario?
Well, that will be an interesting, interesting if that kind of thing happens. But there are, even without a disaster, and we have had fossil fuel facilities destroyed in the past, but for example, several of the contenders for the presidency in 2020 have in their climate plans that no new infrastructure for fossil fuel will be built, and several of them are wanting to ban drilling on public lands. Mm-hmm. That's all good. That will prevent additional fossil fuel from coming into the economy but what needs to be done is not only to not allow any more to be built, but to go ahead before a storm takes them out and start decommissioning refineries and pipelines and all these facilities, and to shut down the import and export of fossil fuels. Now, Larry and I didn't say it in our Cap and Adapt article, but in the book, I'm saying that obviously the industry isn't going to accept that and won't probably cooperate in any kind of permitting system. So it probably is going to require nationalization of the fossil fuel industries. I don't really see any way around it.
Okay, so we are getting close to the end here, so I wonder if maybe we could make sure we get in information for people of how they can find out more. Also, I'd like to know, how do you find things out? What are your sources? You're a scientist, so you probably access things that would be maybe out of reach for me. But what are your sources, and how can people find out more about the Land Institute and what you're doing?
Well, the Land Institute is just landinstitute.org, and the information is there. And then regarding the climate, the whole climate issue, and disasters, howtheworldbreaks.com. And then a subpage of that, howtheworldbreaks.com/onclimate, has a list of links to articles on the kind of issues we've been talking about here today. For example, for that book, Paul and I went to these scenes of former disaster around the world, and talked to people, and went around and saw things. But it also required reading a huge number of both news reports and academic papers, articles, scientific journals, etc. So that's mainly where I get the information.
So that'll be at the address howtheworldbreaks.com/onclimate?
Yes, I'll run together, onclimate.
Okay, and then I thought... go ahead.
Yeah, and then the main page, howtheworldbreaks.com, there are links to a bunch of other stuff and sort of summarizing what the book's about.
Okay. And then I saw some of your work is at resilience.org.
Right. They published several of my articles. And then I'm on the editorial board of another site called greensocialthought.org. Yeah. And that The motto of that site is produce less, distribute it fairly, make a greener world for all, I think mm-hmm. it goes. So that's the philosophy of the writing that you find at Green Social Thought.
Okay. And I wanted to mention one last thing, listeners, that the Land Institute has a YouTube channel.
And we are out of time now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Stan Cox, thanks for being with us today and taking a few questions from callers, and we appreciate having you on board.
Yes, thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy. It's broadcast each second and fourth Friday from 11 to 12 noon here on KZYX and Z. And the next edition will be in 2 weeks with Linda McClure. And for further information, you can go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org.
No doubt we'll agree, this world is our home, not your property.